Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Although changing the structural policies by which media is regulated in the United States is an important component of democratic media reform, a larger, longer-term reform strategy must involve media justice, increasing both representational and ownership diversity in the American media environment across ethnic, gender, and class lines. Though the majority of the United States population is not white, nor male, the majority owns just a fraction of the newspapers, radio, and television stations in the country. This disparity has a range of negative effects on just what information the mainstream media provides to the public. Most notably, says the Reverend Jesse Jackson, is the perpetuation of stereotypes and the restriction of who is considered to be an authority on newsworthy subjects.
I'm often asked to be on television to describe Michael Richards, but I'm not asked my opinion on the Iraq Commission report. Most of the people on the commission had never been to Iraq. I met Saddam Hussein and brought Americans out of Iraq. And so why pigeonhole me just to respond to a broke-down comedian and not talk about war and peace?
However, there are signs that issues of media justice are beginning to receive some serious consideration. Van Jones, founder of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, says a tipping point was reached when Hurricane Katrina ravaged the Gulf Coast.
For years, we've been sold this conservative right-wing ideology of sink or swim, let people sink or swim. And then you saw it. You saw people sinking.
Reverend Jackson says there's ample evidence now that a large segment of the populace is aware that their news and entertainment is being whitewashed and they hunger for more diversity. One way Jackson would like to see the cause of media justice advanced is through the reinstatement of federal tax credits for media conglomerates that divest properties to minority buyers. Dismantlement of this program was Congress's first order of business following the so-called Republican Revolution of 1994. But Van Jones thinks restoration of previous policies does not go far enough. Now is the time to think big.
It does no good to win on net neutrality if net neutrality winds up having a neutral impact on the lives of the people. I would argue that fighting not just at the FCC, as important as that is, but fighting to make sure that every local city and municipality is making free broadband available to everybody has to be number one on our agenda.
To learn more about the issue of media justice and its importance to media reform more generally, visit the Youth Media Council's website at www.youthmediacouncil.org.
It appears that it may be a while now before the Federal Communications Commission's contentious review of media ownership rules is completed. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin now says proposed changes to the rules may take longer than a year to formulate. The elongated time frame is due to multiple factors: massive public backlash to the idea of allowing further consolidation of the media, the FCC's recent promise to finish research projects involving localism and minority media ownership before taking up any rule changes, and the need for the agency to complete a slate of 6 public hearings on the issue. However, on the subject of radio payola, the FCC may be making a move. Investigations by the state of New York into the illegal practice of pay-for-play have already resulted in multi-million-dollar settlements involving every major record label and a few large broadcast companies. But until now, the FCC has sat on the sidelines of New York's probe. Though the agency promised its own investigation, word in Washington is that the FCC plans to announce a settlement with at least 4 broadcast conglomerates accused of participating in payola schemes. The broadcasters would only be required to promise not to engage in further pay-for-play, create an industry payola education program, and commit to reserving airtime for independent music. No admissions of corporate guilt, stiff fines, no station license revocations, and no criminal penalties, though all are called for under the law that the FCC declines to enforce, and there is more than enough evidence that violations were widespread and repeated. Critics of the proposed settlement, which include the Future of Music Coalition, Industry Ears, and Free Press, are calling on the FCC to ditch the deal and properly punish those who run afoul of the law. This would include setting up a program by which an independent third party would keep an eye on music promotion practices and audit broadcast playlists, and would also require broadcasters to make regular disclosures to the FCC on the subject.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today from WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. I'm coming from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We have a long-awaited and terrific show for you today. Our guest joining us on the phone from the Washington, D.C. area, I think, although I'm not sure where Peter is. We'll find out in a second, are two of the executives with the Future of Music Coalition. We're pleased to be joined by the research director of the Future of Music Coalition, Peter DeCola, a Ph.D. candidate in economics at the University of Michigan, who already has received his law degree at the University of Michigan Law School and has emerged as one of the really outstanding researchers on media economics and media policy in the United States, and is the primary author of a brand new research report we'll be talking about on today's show, False Premises, False Promises, A Quantitative History of Ownership Consolidation. Also joining us on the phone is the executive director of the Future of Music Coalition, Jenny Toomey, who's been a guest on this program before and is a well-known figure for people interested in the future of music, the politics of the music industry. Peter, Jenny, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
And Peter, where are you now? Are you in D.C. or
I'm in Ann Arbor, Michigan, trying to finish my dissertation.
Okay. What is your dissertation on radio station ownership?
It is a good chunk of it is, yes.
Excellent. Well, I have no doubt it's going to be a tremendous dissertation. There's a lot to talk about. The issues that both of you work on have been very much in the news. In fact, in our media minutes, you probably heard the reference to the Paola FCC Paola ruling that the Future of Music Coalition was involved in. But first, let's talk, if we can, Peter and Jenny, about the new report, False Premises, False Promises, A Quantitative History of Ownership Consolidation. And before we get into that even, Jenny, why is it that the Future of Music Coalition is doing a study on radio station ownership? Shouldn't that be the FCC's job?
Well, that's an interesting question. Maybe it should. I don't know that the FCC... I don't think there's anything wrong with citizens looking at how the FCC is doing, and that's sort of what Future of Music's had to do. But it would be great if we felt that the FCC was doing a better job of looking very closely at the impact of their policies on the sort of the quality of what people are getting to hear on the public airwaves. The reason we started looking at radio, and this is actually our second study that we've put out, Future of Music's been an organization for about 7 years. And the first one came out, what, like about 4 years ago, Peter, is that right?
Yeah.
And the reason we did it was because I'm a musician. I ran an independent record label. Michael Bracey, who is also a co-founder of Future of Music, runs a different record label. And Kristen, who is a partner in starting Future of Music, is a musician. And we all realized over the years that radio seemed to have gotten worse, and we really couldn't understand why. And we would talk about this on different panels. And people would always say to us, well, you know, you're crazy. There's never been some golden age of radio. It's always been, you know, the same. And so we set out to try to figure that out. First, we looked for existing studies that would talk about radio and any changes we could have seen, and we didn't find very much. And then we actually took the steps of buying industry data and looking at it to try to get a sense of particularly what had happened post-1996, because in 1996 the Telecommunications Act changed the ownership limits. And we knew it was a drastic change, but we really didn't know how much. The first study we put out 4 years ago was sort of, it's interesting because it was very, very interesting for folks who didn't know much about radio. You know, Peter was able to prove that one company, Clear Channel, had gone from only 40 stations before 1996 to almost 1,240 6 years later. And we were able to look at how that transition had really, you know, been devastating to localism and diversity. But this study does a lot more to go sort of into the weeds and really look specifically about what kind of radio we have now in the face of consolidation.
Peter DeCola, research director of Future of Music Coalition and the primary author of the report, False Premises, False Promises. Why don't you just tell our listeners what some of the primary findings of the report are?
Sure. Well, I think... You know, the first, it's sort of split into three chapters. The first looks at national ownership consolidation, and I like to think of that as just a series of charts that either go way, way up or way, way down, you know, like sort of straight lines upward or straight lines downward. It's kind of amazing. The lines that go upward are things like the number of stations owned by the biggest companies, and the things that go downward are things like the number of independent owners of stations, which has decreased by about 33% in the last decade. So then the second chapter goes into something that I think is much closer to sort of people's on the ground experience of radio, and that gets into local ownership consolidation and exactly who owns these companies and what their geographic footprints are. And what you see there is that concentration on the local level is immense. So in just about like 80% of the markets that we looked at, there's concentration well beyond the point where the Department of Justice or the Federal Trade Commission would see cause ordinarily for alarm in terms of the harms that could come from concentrated ownership. There's sort of a threshold along this index called the HHI index the threshold is 1,800, and almost 80% of the markets are beyond that. And so then finally in the third chapter we get to the most sort of exciting part, which is about the effects that all this has had on programming. And we find that, you know, format variety in terms of, you know, which things are available, like country music, news, rock, adult contemporary, you know, jazz, classical, whatever, that variety has not increased in the last decade as a result of consolidation. If anything, it's been stagnant. And we also found maybe one of the most interesting things is that the bulk of the niche formats, and, you know, nowadays jazz and classical count as niche formats because there are so relatively few stations that offer them anymore, those are all being offered by small station groups, not by large station groups. So, you know, the largest station groups in a given city will have 8, 10, 12 stations, and the smallest ones will just have a single station. And there is an economic theory out there that sort of has been driving the push for consolidation for the last couple of decades. And this theory says that the bigger the station group, the more variety they'll offer, because they can afford to, you know, sort of offer an array of products, kind of like the way, I don't know, like Nabisco offers lots of kinds of Oreos now or whatever.
Heinz offers 57 types of ketchup or something.
Exactly. So that theory, it turns out, isn't borne out at all by the data. It's interesting that, you know, it's interesting that no one bothered to look until we did. But the biggest station groups focus on about 6 or 8 formats. They do a lot of the ones I mentioned: country, adult contemporary, top 40, et cetera. And then all of the variety in terms of, you know, sort of out there music programming, or just not, you know, even traditional, you know, sort of heritage type formats like bluegrass or Americana or things like that are offered by the smallest station groups. And so that's sort of the most it's the most shocking finding, in the sense that, you know, the big benefit that we were supposed to get in terms of diversity of programming from allowing radio companies to get as big as they did, it just hasn't materialized. You know, the variety and whatever good things there are on the radio in terms of, you know, programming diversity, those are provided by the smallest groups.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters live today in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on a frozen Sunday afternoon. Our guests today, Jenny Toomey, Executive Director of the Future of Music Coalition, Peter DiCola, the Research Director of the Future of Music Coalition. We're talking right now about the new report the Future of Music Coalition just issued, authored by DiCola, False Premises, False Promises, A Quantitative History of Ownership Consolidation. If you want to find this report online and learn more about the Future of Music Coalition, just go to their website, www.futureofmusic.org. Jenny Toomey, consolidated radio ownership has not been a very good thing for music. That seems to be the conclusion, and I don't think there's a lot of debate about it. I think your study that Peter did probably makes it more stark than some people understood. How did we get in this situation? I mean, I know this 1996 law passed, but how, if it's such a disaster, why isn't this law being changed?
Well, I think the big fear or the big problem with making these kinds of changes is they're very, very difficult to then correct, right? So this is why radio was such a tremendous issue several years ago when media advocates all around the country stood up to the FCC and said, don't allow any further consolidation in other media formats until we understand fully what happened with radio. It's very difficult once you've given allowed large companies to purchase all of these radio stations. It's very hard to get them to give them up.
And I think Michael Kopp said it's like getting the toothpaste back in the tube.
Exactly. And that's why, we did this radio study not simply because we care about radio, and we do, because, you know, as a musician who was lucky enough to tour back before 1996, I knew that you know, all around the country, there were these tremendous non-commercial and college-associated radio stations that would invite my band in, that would allow us to do interviews, that would play our music, and that would, you know, that served as a sort of local hub, probably like the radio that we're on right now. But increasingly, there were fewer and fewer and fewer of those radio stations. The reason we wanted to do this study wasn't simply to raise the alarm about what's happened to radio, but to use the data as a precedent through which we could actually address a lot of the challenges that are coming forward with the Internet and with some of the opportunities that are coming forward with digital radio, as well as low-power radio, as well as you know, any new non-commercial radio stations that the FCC might look to license in the future.
And any listeners who'd like to call in with a question or comment for Jenny Toomey or Peter DeCola, the phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And we definitely want to talk about the issues that Jenny Toomey just mentioned. Peter DeCola, one issue I'd like to talk about is minority ownership. Radio stations historically have been the probably least capital-intensive of our major mass media, certainly compared to daily newspapers or television or film studios. And we're an area where ethnic minorities who did not have a lot of capital could get involved in the ownership. How has minority ownership fared in the past decade?
Well, I mean, the Telecommunications Act of 1996 did no favors for minority owners and minority ownership. I remember at the Senate Commerce Committee hearings in early 2003, we heard from a broadcaster from Syracuse who had run a hip-hop station or an R&B station or some mix of the two genres, that once Clear Channel came to town and bought up a station group of five or six stations, I forget the exact number, was able to sort of price him out of business through the advertising market. Since radio is advertiser-supported, you know, big station groups do have an advantage in terms of being able to offer, you know, a lot more kinds of slots of airtime to people, and they might be, you know, perhaps they offer certain discounts or whatever it is. They develop relationships with local advertisers, and they were able to force this gentleman out of business. And then never, you know, and then eventually programmed their own hip-hop and R&B station, which never achieved the ratings, you know, that his station did, by the way. But, you know, it's just an example of how, because the minority-owned stations tend to be the smaller groups, and some of those were either forced out or bought out, minority ownership has actually decreased. There was an excellent study by Derek Turner and Mark Cooper. Derek's from the Free Press and your organization, of course, and Mark Cooper from Consumer Federation and Consumers Union, and they, you know, documented this really well in a study that must be available somewhere online. That, you know, that's been the most informative work on that issue, and, you know, the news isn't encouraging.
Jenny Toomey, the issue of the whole music industry and the role of radio, which you were talking about earlier, if radio no longer plays the role that it historically has of giving up-and-coming musicians or even established musicians a way to get their material out before prospective listeners who wouldn't hear them otherwise or be familiar with the work. Is this a crisis, or is this being complemented or resolved to some extent by the internet and other technologies?
Well, that's a really, really good question, Bob, because that's another reason why radio is so important for us to do this work. You know, a lot of the work that we do as an organization is based on the belief that, you know, artists need to be able to retain control of their copyrights in order to be able to be, you know, powerful agents and stewards of their careers. And one of the sad facts of a very consolidated radio dial and the sort of rampant payola which we've seen come forth recently because of Attorney General Elliot Spitzer's investigation in New York State, what we find is that artists are basically given a pretty rotten choice, either to not be on commercial radio or to sign a major label deal and sort of purchase a lottery ticket that might someday get them on the radio, but at the same time, you know, sign away their copyrights, which means that they're in a less powerful position down the line. And, you know, this is the thing we've thought was, you know, tremendously outrageous, that in the United States of America, artists can't both be on commercial radio and own their copyrights. And it's very true. You know, when you talk to major managers and major lawyers who work with artists at that level, you know, they'll say the number of artists from that period of time that own their copyrights and are on commercial radio, you know, you can count them on one or two hands.
Well, Jenny, how about, YouTube and the Internet? How realistic is it currently or prospectively also? It's a two-part question then. Will it replace radio and offer musicians a way to directly reach new fans and even conceivably sell their music directly?
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, the second part of the question is now how the Internet is actually playing in the face of this sort of consolidated radio environment. And I think, yes, we're actually seeing that. You know, one of the main reasons we started Future of Music was because I wanted to fully understand how these emerging technologies might benefit artists, and I wanted to reflect that information back to musicians so they could make better choices and they could actually be on the record, because generally artists are often used as just mascots for whatever team, whether it's the technology side or the content side, and artists aren't always weighing in intimately about what they really want. But what I can say is that we've been promised all sorts of wonderful things from the Internet for quite a while, for at least, I'd say, 9 years. People have been talking about this sort of utopic future where a fan can connect immediately with an artist, and an artist can, you know, can monetize that, and it's frictionless, and you don't have to sign any contracts. And honestly, what's interesting is an element of that is actually, I think, coming true and coming to fruition finally now. And the way I see it happen is I see artists on independent labels breaking through a certain ceiling of record sales that was almost impossible just 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So artists that stay on record labels like Merge or Touch and Go or Sub Pop can also sell like over 150,000 copies of a record, which is unseen. You know, it never happened before. And I think also it's interesting to hear that that's happening at the same time that record sales on as a whole are down for the industry. So, yeah, I'm optimistic that this can be a solution, but I'm also concerned that the openness that we've seen in the Internet is not necessarily a given, and there's certainly forces at work to try to close up that openness and create new bottlenecks that they can monetize.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Jenny Toomey, who you've just been listening to, the Executive Director of the Future of Music Coalition. Also joining us on the phone from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Peter DiCola, the Research Director of the Future of Music Coalition. We're discussing the state of radio, the music industry, new technologies, and in particular, Peter DiCola's new report, False Premises, False Promises, A Quantitative History of Ownership Consolidation. If you want to learn more about that report or all of the work of the Future of Music Coalition, their web address is www.futureofmusic.org. And if you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the number here at Media Matters at WILL-AM 580 is 333-9455, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Peter DiCola, one of the issues that Jenny Toomey just mentioned a few minutes ago was satellite radio, and that is sort of a new technology that's come on. And how does satellite radio, in your view, fit into the radio industry? How is it changing it? What is its role? And what influence or impact will it have on the music and musicians?
Well, in terms of, you know, the best data we have about programming is about is at the level of formats, as I was talking about before. And in terms of a response, you know, on the format front, we haven't seen one. You know, one of the great features of XM and Sirius, right, is that they offer, you know, I know that XM offers five or six jazz channels among their 100-plus channels of programming. And so you would think maybe that, you know, if XM is doing well, that, you know, in offering this much jazz, that maybe some, you know, traditional broadcasters would think to offer jazz. But we haven't seen that kind of response, you know, which, you know, maybe economically means that the, you know, the jazz audience is dispersed enough so much geographically that, you know, jazz can't make it on a local level. That might be a theory. I don't necessarily buy that. I think that, you know, the reason we see such a tiny array of formats is mainly because it's cheaper to offer very homogenous programming. But anyhow, in terms of the satellite radio and its effect, I haven't seen one at the level of formats. I mean, it may have been contributing to the decline in overall radio listenership, but, you know, the decline in radio listenership started in 1989, as we document in our report, and satellite radio wasn't off the ground at all yet, and things were still quite uncertain as to whether satellite radio would ever get off the ground at that point in 1989. So, you know, the problem in terms of, you know, whether radio was appealing to listeners and able to retain its audience, I mean, that predates a lot of the new technologies that people like to point to and blame. And, you know, the most important thing to remember, I think, in the policy, for the policy debate, is that new technology shouldn't be a reason to you know, entrench or reinforce an old business model. I mean, I think that the thing that radio has to do is to focus on what it has that the new technologies don't, such as localism, its ability to do live radio like this, things like that, where, you know, those things aren't tried. And, you know, we've seen some radio, you know, especially in the non-commercial sector, thrive over the last decade. So I think that what's interesting is that radio hasn't, at least as a collective, you know, hasn't really responded to the challenge from satellite yet. But, you know, I don't think that you can necessarily blame satellite for its problem.
Well, Jenny Toomey, I hope that the station manager of WILL AM 580 isn't listening at this time or doesn't get this podcast. But, you know, you look at the internet and you look at the ability, it doesn't take much bandwidth to put a radio signal up on the internet. Is there really any justification for having traditional terrestrial radio broadcasting in the next generation? Or are we really dealing with a horse and buggy technology that we should just sort of, you know, put to sleep?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean,
I like that. You're grading. I like it. I get an A on that one.
Well, it's got to be a good question because it's one of the first ones we've been asked almost every time when we do this work, which is, mm-hmm. you know, who cares about radio? Give up on radio. It's mm-hmm. like you're arguing for water closets or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is people who live in communities that actually have good local programmed radio know that there's nothing that substitutes for it, at least not yet. Maybe if you could get, you know, if you could, you have wireless in the car, you can actually get some of these spectacular new webcasts and podcasts in your car, you know, it'll give local radio a run for its money. But the fact of the matter is, you know, Future Music was lucky enough to go down to New Orleans about, I guess it was almost 2.5 months ago. We brought a number of major artists who've worked with us on all sorts of issues, including media consolidation, down there to study net neutrality and a number of issues we're working on, but also to see what was going on with the music community there and do a benefit concert. And there is a radio station, WWOZ, that is the embodiment of what real local radio can do to a community. This community is completely devastated. Depending on who you talk to, 50% to at least a third of all of the musicians are gone and not planning on coming back. You know, most of the people who live there have lost everything, and it's a very sad place. But there's hope, and there's an incredible resurgence in belief in the importance of culture there. And this radio station is that embodiment. You turn it on, you know, the guys who give you your rental car will make sure it's WWOZ when you get in there, and you listen to the richest music you've ever heard, folks helping each other, connecting to one another, wishing each other happy birthday, telling each other about the festivals that are happening, the volunteer projects they can work on. And this radio station doesn't just reflect back this, you know, really rich culture, which it's almost impossible to get on the radio anywhere else in the country, but they also, you know, work with the Tipitina Foundation to get artists their instruments again. They work with the Musicians Clinic to make sure that musicians can have the health care they need. And this is something that isn't yet replicated in any other format, certainly not satellite radio and in most cases nowhere near on the Internet as well.
I'd also, if I could interject just quickly,
yeah,
I would
please
say
do,
one
Peter.
Of the big things about radio is that the receivers are really cheap. You know, they're a cheap, ubiquitous technology, and in the face of the rising economic inequality that we're seeing, I think that it's important to remember that not everyone has broadband access. I think when we last checked the Pew Internet site when we published the study last month, the rate of broadband adoption or the status of broadband adoption was something like 48%. Now, I'm sure people differ on that number precisely, but, you know, either way, whether the number is 40% or 60%, whatever kind of range you want to put on it, there's a huge swath of society that doesn't really have the technology to get Internet radio at home in any kind of convenient format. So I think that at least for this moment right now, and probably for the, you know, the medium term at least, I think that, you know, traditional radio has huge importance for lots of people.
Well, Peter, while I've got you here, let me ask you about Clear Channel. They are the radio chain that we've already mentioned on this program that gobbled up 1,200 radio stations, became sort of the Pentagon of commercial radio broadcasting, the poster child of all the enemies of consolidation, would always point to Clear Channel. And now Clear Channel is in some sort of crisis financially, it seems like, and is, you know, selling. Could you explain to listeners who said, if consolidation is so great, why is Clear Channel not swimming in profits?
Yeah, right. Well, that's the thing. I, you know, the consolidation isn't so great. So what I would point to, I guess, as an economist, I have to point to the flawed economic theory that this was based on. So there's this economic concept called economies of scale, and what it means is that as your company gets bigger, your per unit costs get lower, you know, and so the idea is that's why, you know, Ford's factories are really big instead of, you know, we have three auto companies instead of, you know, 300. The problem is that that's just a description of reality. It's not a prescription for reality. And, you know, you can just as, you know, a priori, you could have economies of scale or you could have diseconomies of scale. And while radio may have some obvious economies of scale, such as, you know, okay, every radio station's employees can use the same, you know, payroll department or whatever, it isn't the case that you can hold the quality. It may not be the case that you can hold the quality of radio constant while, you know, sort of becoming this large behemoth. You know what I mean? The economies of scale also requires that the quality of the product stay the same and the cost go down. So I think that, you know, Clear Channel's costs might have gone down. They might have fired a lot of DJs or used new technology to get rid of a lot of, you know, of employees, you know, programming directors and other layers. But they also didn't keep up the quality and weren't able to offer the same kinds of service that certainly that they were promising. So their stock price has gone down consistently for the last 6-7 years, and they've decided finally to sell off about a third of their stations. They're selling off whole groups in any market that's outside of the top 100 ranked markets. So basically, anywhere in a town that's like the size of Ann Arbor or smaller, I think they're getting rid of their holdings, or at least they've announced that they will. And, you know, to me, it's just a demonstration that economies of scale weren't there, that it was a flawed economic theory. It was something that people thought was there just because people said it was there. It made some sort of intuitive sense, even though everyone knows that it can also, you know, too many cooks spoil the broth, right? That's an example of diseconomies of scale. You don't need 7 people to make one soup, right? And you may not need, you know, 1,200 stations to have profitable radio. It may be much better to have smaller local groups, and, you know, both are perfectly plausible, you know. So I think that this is something we talked about in our report 4 years ago. It's something that's definitely come to a head now, and, you know, I think that in some ways it's a good sign, but, you know, Clear Channel is still going to be very large. They still may be beyond the scale that would be best, you know, for society, and it's also a real question exactly where these new stations are going to go. Are they going to go to just some medium-sized groups, or are the stations they sell off going to go to independent and minority owners?
Our guest today, Peter DiCola, who you've just been listening to, Research Director at the Future of Music Coalition, and Jenny Toomey, the Executive Director of the Future of Music Coalition. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. Jenny, when I was coming of age in Cleveland, Ohio, back in the 1960s, to date myself, there was a major payola scandal with some of the leading disc jockeys in the city, and it was a scandal across the country in the late 50s and early 60s and took a number of careers, disc jockeys who were paid off under the table by record labels to play certain artists, to give them priority for to be played over the air to the benefit of those artists, obviously. And I was always under the belief that that was it, that the FCC had cracked down, the government had cracked down, and people understood if you took money to play music, you know, your career was over. That was like a capital punishment, in effect, for someone in the radio industry. You've referred to a study done by Elliot Spitzer. We've had Paul Porter on this show from Industry Years a couple months ago. Apparently, payola still exists, and it's still a major problem. Are disc jockeys getting paid off? What has been going on?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, payola is a very, very difficult problem to fix. And what you find is, you know, when a law is changed, people often find workarounds. And if you talk to people who have been involved in the music industry for 50 years, they'll talk about, you know, the people who were there before them who used to pay off people who manufactured sheet music. So, you know, the more popular singers would perform the compositions. It's not hard to understand why payola can be a problem in this industry. That said, you know, what Peter was able to identify in our first radio study in 2004 was that we believed payola was alive and well because you could just look at what was being programmed on the radio and there was no independent artist at all, which basically meant that either there was something going on, which meant that if you had a relationship with a major label, you had a better chance of getting on the radio, or the major labels were doing a 100% good job of identifying songs that should be played on commercial radio.
And then, yeah.
What Spitzer found was something that we had been hearing about from, you know, as long as we've been part of our organization. People really didn't call it payroll for a long time. But it's independent radio promotion, which basically meant that, you know, in the traditional form of payola, let's say, McChesney, you have your own radio station, and I want you to play Peter DeCola's new 7-inch of his Economic Theorem band. And so I go over to your house, and I give you some money or some favors, and you play that song for me. And it's pretty clear that's payola. But the new form of payola was once removed, where basically there would be independent radio promoters who would have exclusive contracts with radio groups, and they would be paid for those relationships. And then you would, as a record label, would establish a relationship with that independent radio promoter. So you could see how money would flow not directly to the radio station, but through the independent radio promoter, or in many cases it would be billed back. So as songs were added to charts, the independent radio promoter would then get added pay from the record label. So it was kind of a way to slightly insulate themselves from overt payola. But, you know, all Spitzer had to do was subpoena some documents, and it became very clear what was going on. In so doing, he managed to settle lawsuits with three of the five major labels and now one of the radio companies, Entercom, and he then sent all of the documents to the FCC, where it's been sitting for almost a full year. I know that FCC Commissioner Adelstein has been doing talking about this quite a bit, and I know that he's been very active in trying to figure out a solution, which I'm sure that Paul Porter had talked about. But, you know, it's been very, very slow going.
Well, the FCC did announce some findings just this past week. What did it find, and what is your take on it?
What did the FCC find this week?
Well, I saw that there was a press release that the Future of Music Coalition had on the FCC's payola.
Yes, well, I think what we've heard is that they're coming to an agreement, and what that press statement was an attempt to get out in front of it and say very clearly that, you know, we've heard that there is a settlement, and it better be a settlement that actually has some teeth to it. That, you know, if the major labels are being forced to pay millions and millions of dollars for engaging in this, we don't understand how the radio companies can get off with a slap on the wrist. And that even more importantly, there needs to be accountability and transparency in a way to make sure that this kind of payola doesn't reinstitute itself in some other form, and that what we really want is to make sure that the airwaves actually put musicians on there based on merit and not relationships. So there needs to be a way for, you know, people have talked about different ways to do this. I know that Paul Porter is talking about trying to figure out a way to get independent artists into the testing pools, which is like the first step of the ramp through which artists actually might ever get on commercial radio. But I think mostly this is just this was an attempt of many organizations to say this better be a real deal, or else, you know, we won't be happy with it.
Peter DeCola, I saw a piece by a musician not too long ago, and I can't remember who the musician was, but a fairly well-known alternative musician who had sort of his top five list for what music should happen in the next decade if he had his way. And I think on the top five list, if not at the very top, was destruction of all iPods. what is your take on the iPod, and how is that affecting the music industry, and where do you think it's going to fit into the mix down the road?
Well, I think one interesting response that you did see in radio, the one sort of new format that I saw developed over the sort of new class of formats that developed in the last just couple of years is this idea of Jack radio or Bob radio or Hank radio or Kim radio. Just they brand it with a name, and it's basically a deeper playlist that essentially acts like an iPod. It's a relatively small iPod. It's only got 400 or 500 songs, but it's a much deeper playlist than the usual 50 or 100 songs that you'd see on a typical station. So that's one interesting effect it's had. I guess I don't have nearly so negative a view of the iPod. I think that it certainly has changed the industry in terms of its, you know, in its connection with iTunes and beginning to get the sort of legal download market going. I think that it's had, you know, a positive effect.
What percentage of music sales are iTunes at this point? Do you have any idea?
I do. I think I just recently was looking at the RIAA statistics, although I'm not gonna get the number right off the top of my head. But it was Jenny, isn't it getting to be something like 5 or 10%? I'm not sure.
I think it might even be more than that, but, but you know, why don't we try to find it while we're talking here?
Well, Jenny, what is your sense? Well, I'll give you a chance to deal with this. I know the iPod is, you know, a raging technology. How do you see it affecting the music industry and prospective musicians coming along like you did?
I love it. I really do. You know, most people don't realize that, you know, 10 years ago, the way that an artist got in trouble wasn't, or a label, an indie label got in trouble, you know, it wasn't when they had like three or four bands that were just selling about 3,000 records. It was when one of them sold 20. Because at that moment, you know, you had very little reserves. You know, you spent all your money to make the 5,000 copies, and suddenly it looks like it's going to sell another five, and you scrimp up the money to make the other five. But, you know, you're a small label, so you get paid on 90-day consignment, which means, you know, you could waste as much as 6 months to a year before you get paid back for the first 10,000 records that you've paid for, and you lose that window when that artist is actually a rising star, when it could actually meet that audience demand. And this is the moment when indie labels generally make a bad decision. They either lose their artist to a major label, or they partner with a major label to have a P&D deal, which is a production and distribution deal, which basically means they thin slice even more the very small amount of royalties that they make from selling these records. So the idea of getting rid of the physical album, you know, while, you know, my record label, Simple Machines, was known for colored vinyl and hand silk screened, you know, 7 inches, and even some made out of flocked wallpaper. We liked packaging. But ultimately, giving packaging up in exchange for artists being able to scale without actually signing their rights away, it seems like a fair trade to me. And, you know, you can always, artists can always make beautifully packaged things that they can sell on top of this. It's just, it's really spectacular to me to think that, you know, an artist can sell 10,000 7-inches, the equivalent of them, through iTunes without actually having to put out the cost of making every single one of them, shipping it, storing it, all of that. So, yeah, I think it's great.
Our guest today. Oh, go ahead, Peter.
I was just going to say the figure is 8.4%.
Yeah, I think it was 8, yeah.
So I put the bands around a pretty good 5 or 10.
And at the rate of growth, Peter, being an economist, but where would you guess at the current rate of growth that figure would be, say, 2 years from today?
2 years from now, I bet it's up to 15 or 20%. It doubled in the last – it doubled from the mid-2005 to mid-2006. So I'd say, it might double or a little more again in the next couple of years. I think that sounds about right. But.
Well, and the video iPod stuff happened, you know, like three times as fast.
Mm-hmm.
The adoption rate for those was much quicker.
The one point I'd make about why it's good for the music industry is that you see real price competition. So on iTunes, songs are 99 cents, but if you have a subscription to eMusic – then the songs, I don't know, my eMusic subscription, I pay about 18 cents a track. Now, on eMusic, only independent labels choose to price their things that low. But it's just interesting. You've got a big, the difference between 18 cents and 99 cents is a lot different percentage-wise than the difference between, you know, bargain CDs and full-price CDs. You know, it's instead of being, you know, half the price of full-price CDs, the bargains online are something more like 20% of the price. So, you know, I think that that's been really healthy for the industry. I think it's spurred a lot more interest. You know, lower prices per track makes a lot of sense to me. I think they're probably driving a fair amount of volume. You see that in the RIAA's year-end figures. You know, even though the total dollars hasn't quite restored the industry to where it was a few years ago, I still think that in the end that's going to be a good thing.
Well, Jenny, do you think that with this going on, that the long-standing fear of the recording industry, the labels, and I think of artists, that their music would be sent around for free and they would get no compensation. Is this being lessened by the emergence of iTunes?
Oh, that'll never happen. Just kidding. that's the hardest question right there. You know, people are creating a lot of files free and getting to listen to a lot of files through different formats that were never supposed to be established as free. You know, a lot of the music that I hear for the first time that I love the most is from music blogs, where a super fan, it's like the equivalent of those fanzines I loved 10 and 12 years ago, but I don't have to send away for the 7-inch. But I do find artists that I then go and see, and I find albums that I go and buy. Maybe I'm the exception. I know that, you know, there's a tremendous fear that the generation coming up under me, maybe the age of your daughters, Bob, I won't ask what happened to the computers at the McChesney house.
No illegal downloading at our house.
Okay, well, good.
Yeah.
But there's a fear that kids who come up in a climate where it's that easy to download anything they want for free will have a hard time paying for it. And I think the real the only way to solve that problem, well, there's two things. One, it's to license everything and make it available in a way that it feels free. You know, what Peter's talking about with 18 cents a track on his e-music, or Rhapsody, where you can actually stream all the music that they have on that in that music page for, you know, a flat fee of the month, you know, it feels the same, and it actually has a higher quality than, you know, poking around through LimeWire or other kinds of places like that. But even more importantly, I think this tremendous connection that fans can have with their artists, you know, through their websites and through the Internet, really hopefully will connect that bond, because, you know, when I bought that Joni Mitchell record that first time, I didn't realize that I would end up buying it, like, I don't know, what, 20 other times, you know, or when my friend first downloaded certain songs, or not downloaded, but, you know, made me a cassette copy of some of his favorite songs from some album, you know, I never knew that I was going to end up going out and rebuying that album three or four times just simply because I loved it so much, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it is very complex, and, you know, when you hear about things like, you know, my, what is it, allmp3.com in Russia, where, you know, basically you can get everything for a penny a track, or, you know, there's other parts of the world where people are putting the entirety of, you know, all of Joni Mitchell's albums on one CD, you know, mm-hmm. and then, you know, selling it to you. You know, that is frightening, but, you know, I have to believe that the technology, these sort of other benefits that we're getting from these technologies are going to outweigh these challenges that we face in the transition.
You're listening to Jenny Toomey, Executive Director of the Future Music Coalition. Also joining us on the air, Peter DeCola, Research Director of the Future of Music Coalition. We're talking about the state of the music industry, media ownership, radio ownership in particular. Peter DeCola, author of the brand new report, False Premises, False Promises, A Quantitative History of Ownership Consolidation. If you want to learn more about the Future of Music Coalition, go to their website, www.futureofmusic.org. We have a caller patiently waiting, but before we go to that caller, I want to turn to you, Peter, and follow up on what Jenny's just been talking about. As I'm listening to what Jenny Toomey was just saying, as an economist, as I would like your opinion. I look at what's going on in the music industry, where you're really evolving toward a digital era in which stores aren't going to play the same role, in which the physical manufacture and distribution of discs of one sort or another are going to play a much smaller role, maybe eventually be eliminated. What exactly do we need record companies for anymore? What is the function of those guys? What value added are they bringing to the equation in the digital era?
Well, they function a lot like a bank, to tell you the truth. You know, that's the financial function is a large portion of what's left. So, you know, they're providing artists and bands with basically an advance of money against, you know, future earnings. So it's sort of like they're a highly specialized and educated, you know, financial institution that says, okay, we think that you're a good bet to sell a few records, and we're going to give you an advance of $100,000, and, you know, that's going to come out of your future royalties, and, you know, we're going to try to help you make, you know, in the best case, what they're going to do is to help that band make that money back and then some, but obviously that's not what happens 95% of the time. A lot of bands don't ever recoup that advance, but that's the idea. So I think the financial part and sort of bearing that risk and possibly, you know, you can think of a record label as holding a portfolio of risky albums, you know, and one of them a year is going to hit really big, and a couple more are going to hit not quite as big, but enough to be profitable, and then a bunch more are going to not pan out. And so I think especially they see themselves as, you know, financial institutions.
So they're basically a futures market.
I would say so. Now, you know, a lot of musicians don't like to hear record labels talk about them talk about the thing that way, but I think, you know, you can couch that in really negative terms, or you can give it more positive connotations.
Well, do you think they can survive as a futures market, or is that enough of an economic function that they will continue to dominate music in the next generation or two in the digital era as they have for the past quarter century?
Yeah, I think that for, you know, certainly in the medium term, they're going to stick around. I think, you know, lots of people were saying 7 years ago when we first started Future Music Coalition that the record industry was dead, was dying, was going to be gone in 5 years. And obviously it's not. But, there is a real question in terms of, are they the best at finding and nurturing talent? You know, are they providing some extra service in terms of, you know, are they really good at identifying what the public wants? Or is it just, you know, I think it's also valid to say that part of what happens is that they're able to manufacture hits because, you know, they've got a certain, you know, they've got certain entrees into media like radio, where they're a gatekeeper such that they can manufacture a certain number of hits every year and say, this is what's going to be popular. We're going to play this 100,000 times, and eventually a lot of people are going to buy this. You know, the treatment, for instance, that the artists who are on American Idol get is amazing. What the nexus between, you know, Fox and radio stations and the record industry that just says, listen, everything that these people put out is going to get covered in magazines, is going to, you know, sell a certain number of records. Some of them are going to be huge smash hits. You know, I think that that's the more disturbing side of it, is that they're sort of entrenched because there are certain connections that are forged, like Jenny was talking about earlier, that almost everything on the radio is a major label release. You know, the major labels have a certain amount of sort of entrenched power where they, you know, sure, it's risky. If you look at one individual album, you don't know that that's going to be the hit. But you do know that the major labels are going to have a certain number of hits each year because, you know, that's what they do. They manufacture these hits. So I think the mass, you know, the mass market model that they've got has been somewhat self-perpetuating. I don't necessarily see it as reflective of some, you know, actual value. But then again, to answer your question, like, does it seem like they'll stick around? Well, because of that entrenched power, I think that maybe they will.
Well, you know, we've got a caller that has been waiting very patiently. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Fryna, Illinois, hotbed of digital music here on Media Matters.
Hi. I like the idea that people have a choice to either hold a recording in their possession or be able to hear it occasionally on a broadcast media. And I think, going back to another thing that was said earlier, that the quality of the broadcaster, the quality of the programming is crucial. I have two questions. How do they determine ratings for radio stations anymore? I thought I heard some change in the way Arbitron does its work. I've only filled out one Arbitron form in my whole life, and it was about 20 years ago. Also, I'm curious about how does a song, like, let's say a broadcaster wants to play a Beatles tune, do they have to pay for the rights to broadcast that tune? Okay, that's all I wanted to ask. Thanks.
Okie dokie.
Those are great questions. I can answer the first one, which is that, yes, Arbitron has recently changed the way they do some of their surveying. They're making a gradual transition to what they call a portable people meter, which is meant to get a better read on what, you know, I think it's some kind of device that actually tracks how people are using media instead of relying on them to fill out the survey forms. I'm not describing it exactly right, but I think that's the general idea, is that they're hoping to understand, you know, what media people are actually exposed to, as opposed to what they remember being exposed to and write down on a survey card. As far as the second question, for traditional radio airplay, the composers and songwriters of a song will get compensated through a blanket license that's administered by these organizations called performing rights organizations, ASCAP and BMI are the two largest. And they'll be compensated, but actually because of a interesting and sort of traditional sort of power struggle between the record industry and the radio industry, the radio does not have to pay the recording artists. So every piece of music comes with two copyrights. The composition does get compensated for radio play, but the sound recording does not.
Jenny, Jenny, please go ahead.
Yeah. So what that means is, you know, if Willie Nelson writes the song Crazy and Patsy Cline sings it, every time it's played on the radio, Willie Nelson will be affiliated with either ASCAP or BMI, and theoretically he will be paid through his service organization by the radio station. But Patsy Cline will not be paid because she's a performer. And what's interesting is in 75 other countries, the performers are paid as well. So in the United States, you know, we are sort of the largest music marketplace where we don't compensate the performer, but only the songwriter. There is an exception to that, which is for webcasting and for digital broadcast of music, and there's an organization called Sound Exchange that collects that royalty and pays the performer, but that's only for, you know, the music you can hear on your cable system or for webcasts.
Jenny,
and also for satellite radio as well.
Jenny Toomey, we've only got a couple minutes left, and, you know, For listeners who have listened to all this and have heard what Peter DeCole has been saying about concentration in radio, are there a few shorthand recommendations you would make or Future of Music Coalition would make to improve the situation of radio in this country, a checklist of this is what we think ought to be done to really improve radio for the public and for musicians?
Yeah, actually, we have a five-piece fixing radio agenda.
What a coincidence.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. One, we want to retain the current local ownership caps to prevent any further consolidation. Then we'd like, to consider new regulations that promote radio ownership by small, independent, and minority broadcasters. Three, we would end structural payola once and for all. Four, we would expand and protect non-commercial radio, including low-power FM, and there'll be a big fight next year to try to make sure that happens in urban markets. And finally, we want to ensure that the transition from analog to digital radio, which we didn't talk about at all today, but the radio is moving from analog to digital, which means that the people who own the licenses actually could get as many as a couple extra streams through them. And we want to make sure that when they do that transition, that it directly implements the concepts of localism, competition, and diversity. In other words, that the same old people shouldn't get all that extra capacity if they're not doing stuff to serve the public with it.
Yeah, that is a very important issue, the transition to digital radio, and I had it on my list along with a number of other things we didn't get to. What is the timeline right now for when the FCC will be considering putting together a formal plan?
Well, you know, there are people who are already rolling out HD signals right mm-hmm. now, and the formal plan, as far as we can tell, is that the people who have the licenses get the capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, if that's not what we want, we really need to figure out a way to organize, and Future of Music's been talking about it for about a year, but, you know, to really fight to make sure that, you know, if Clear Channel has 1,200 radio stations, they really don't need 3,600 of them. You know, we want to make sure that that extra capacity goes places where, you know, there can be a jazz station in every community. There can be local news in every community, you know. It should go where it's needed and not just where it is.
And we've only got a little bit left, Jenny Toomey. What are some of the other issues that Future of Music Coalition will be working on in the next year?
Well, the biggest issue for next year for Future of Music is net neutrality. And the principle of net neutrality, I'm sure you've talked about it on your show.
About 7,000 times.
Okay, so the idea, you know, we call it, because of, you know, who we talk to, we call it Internet payola. You know, we think musicians understand what it's like to be on the wrong side of a bottleneck for radio. You know, they understand that if they weren't affiliated with a major and if they weren't paying huge amounts of money, they couldn't get on commercial radio. We've been trying to parallel that with what's happening with the idea of a tiered internet, where people would pay more to get their information through quickly. And we're pretty assured that all of this openness that musicians have been promised for the past years would disappear in a tiered internet environment. So we think it's a no-brainer that all musicians want to make sure that you get to their website as quickly as you get to Sony.com or whoever else's website.com. And for that reason, we're going to try to get every musician in the country on the record affirming the principle of net neutrality this year.
Okay, I think our time is coming to a close. Peter DeCola, Research Director of the Future of Music Coalition, Jenny Toomey, Executive Director, Future of Music Coalition, thank you both so much for joining us today at Media Matters.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Bob.
It's been a real pleasure. Good luck with all your work. And listeners, I'm going to be in Madison the rest of the spring, but we'll be doing our live show from up there. I want to thank you all very much, and I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer. See you in a week.